Welcome back to another episode of the SSPC podcast. I'm your host, Bree McCullough.
And I'm your other host, Mike Klein. On today's episode, we're sitting down with Vice President of Protective Coding Services for AB Kalin LLC, Troy Frabel, and SSPC Technical Services Specialist and PCC Support Specialist, Don Molinari, to discuss the different types of protective coatings and when to use them. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
As we know, since SSPC was founded in 1950, our mission has focused on the use of coatings to protect industrial steel structures. In the past 70 years, the coatings industry technology and materials has expanded as new technology comes out.
From the different types of coatings used in the field to the different methods of applying them, the coatings industry is a highly technical field, and coatings professionals must be trained and knowledgeable on all the newest standards and technology.
Which is why today's conversation is going to be about the basics of protective coatings and when to use them.
For those who might be new to the industry, Troy, can you tell us a little bit about the purpose of protective coatings?
Most basic answer is corrosion prevention, right? You'll hear most people say that. Some people will say corrosion control, but I think control is a little bit overstated. It's sort of like the pandemic. We can mitigate the situation, but we really can't control it. So the most important thing to remember about protective coatings is preventing corrosion. It's a natural process. It's inevitable. Some people will also include appearance and aesthetics, color, decontamination for nuclear facilities and such. But really, again, corrosion prevention is the main goal.
So protective coatings are on everything, from bridges to water tanks, ships or railways, and many more. Don, other than steel, what other materials are we protecting from deterioration with coatings?
Well, I've seen certainly other than steel, concrete has become a major substrate, a big player in the protection industry. The DOTs really are using a lot of concrete. I've noticed in my time, especially since I've been with SSPC the last couple of years, but prior to that as well. Non-ferrous metals, such as aluminum and stainless steel, when they decide to get coated, certainly are also being protected with, proper surface prep and a proper coating system. Something that you don't hear too much about in the protective coating industry, but wood also plays a role, but obviously not a major one, I wouldn't think. There's certainly, light industrial acrylic coating systems and still your conventional industrial enamel systems that get used on wood too for protection.
So there are obviously a lot of different materials that we can protect with coatings. And actually last month we had our October episode of the SSPC podcast. We focused on protective coatings for concrete. So I think for purposes of this discussion, let's focus on steel.
I'm glad you picked steel, Mike, because I joined SSPC when it was the Steel Structures Painting Council. So I'm glad that we're going to stick on that subject. But that being said, do you guys want the 1-hour lunch and learn version, or do you want the 4-hour training class version of coding types?
I think we'll go for the lunch and learn. And, if you could, just kind of give us the broad overview, to that point, what are the different types of coatings on steel, Troy?
Okay, so here's, again, real simple answers. The Cadillac coating system, and even when I started 30 years ago, it's still pretty much there. It's zinc-rich primers, direct-to-blast-cleaned metal, epoxy intermediate build coats to make the coating thicker, a better barrier, and then polyurethane top coats to protect those two layers from UV. And also the good thing about polyurethane, it'll give you color and gloss, and it'll make whatever structure, bridge, whatever you're painting, water tank, whatever it is, it'll make it look a little prettier on the outside. So in a little bit more detail, again, on the zinc rich, for those of you new to the business, think about galvanizing. So a zinc rich epoxy or an inorganic zinc, which is a story for another day, those materials do a great job of protecting steel when the coating system happens to get damaged. Epoxies have been the workhorse since I've been in the business. They continue to be the workhorse material for not just intermediate coats. They can also be used as a primer direct to steel. And as long as UV light isn't present, epoxies can also be used as a top coat if you're inside of a water treatment plant or wastewater treatment plant, something like that. Now, on the polyurethane side, if you want to kick it up a notch, you can actually use products, newer products now that are called fluorourethanes, which have extremely good durability and color and gloss retention. So if you don't take anything else away from what we're discussing today, remember those three. For the older people on the call, alkyd, okay, old oil-based paint, if you want to think about that. Again, they can be used as primers, intermediates, and top coats. Red lead, you know, red lead primers, which are long since gone, which had a lot of solvent in them, were a workhorse back in the day. Alkyds don't build that thick, so you do have to do it in multiple coats. Solvent, you know, the old versions that were very user-friendly had a lot of solvent. Solvents are going away because of VOC concerns. And then on the top coat side, if you don't modify an alkyd with a silicone or something, it is going to chalk and fade very, very badly, just like an epoxy would. So, but they're still there. And especially if it's the maintenance crew, you know, on the bridge for the DOT or the maintenance crew in the plant, single component, easy to use, very forgiving, put the lid back on the can and you can go for it. Even more forgiving for the user and easier are the acrylics. And again, we have acrylic primers, intermediates, and by their very nature, they're actually very good top coats. So when I was in the water tank market a lot, I would recommend acrylic overcoats as top coats because they're very forgiving, less stressful, and great for color and gloss retention. One thing to warn people about, though, acrylic primers, when you put them to metal, have got to have inhibitors in them because the acrylics are, think about house paint, water-based house paint for the outside of your house, you know, similar technology. But if you put it on metal and you put water on metal, it's going to rust. So you need to make sure if you are going to put it in acrylic to steel that it has a rust inhibitor in it. Some more complicated materials or different materials are also the moisture-cured urethanes. So this is a similar to the polyurethane I mentioned as a top coat. Instead of being a two-component material, it's a one-component material, and what you're adding to it actually is moisture from the air. So very good in the upper northwest in places where you have humidity, places where very often you can't use these other materials, moisture-cured urethanes work very, very well. Primers, intermediates, top coats. If it's a top coat, make sure that it's an aliphatic polyurethane, and that also goes for the top coats I mentioned earlier. We won't get into the chemistries at this point. And the other interesting things about the moisture-cured urethanes is they are typically, the primers and intermediate coats, reinforced with micaceous iron oxide. You can't put them on very thick, and so that micaceous iron oxide helps build that barrier a little bit better. Some of the other newer technologies, and again, I'm looking at the outside of a steel structure, are the polysiloxanes. And in that case, you actually take the advantages of a polyurethane, but you also can build it with a thickness like an epoxy. And so you get two for one. So instead of a thin coat, I can put on one thick coat that will give me the barrier that I would normally just get from the epoxy and the UV protection. Downside there being you really have to spray apply it to get that advantage. And if you're painting a bridge or an elevated water tank or a lot of structures where there's cars and people around, you're probably not going to be able to spray. So you're back to three coats. You might lose that advantage. The other thick build is truly just a polyurethane that the class is called a polyaspartic. Same thing. So now I'm using polyurethane in a thick build. But to get that advantage, you have to spray apply it. So the other class I think about is when I think about immersion service. All right. So what do we put on steel in immersion? Immersion in water. What did I say the workhorse was? Epoxy. Guess what? Polyamide epoxies are great in water, and any day of the week, three-coat polyamide epoxy in water is fantastic. You get to chemicals and oils and other things like that, then you want to look at an amine-cured epoxy. If you want to take that up another step, there is a class called an epoxy Novolac. Much better chemical resistance, a little bit harder to work with and mix. Surface prep becomes a lot more important. Even harder than that technology are the 100% solids epoxies. So now I can take all the solvent out of the epoxy. I can build it to 50 plus mils, a thousandth of an inch thick. But very often I have to use complicated plural component application equipment where epoxy, just like epoxy glue, part A, part B, you would normally mix together, wait a while, put it on. The 100% solids have got to come out of separate buckets and then mix actually in the line right before they go to the gun. All right, so it's a little bit more difficult technology there. But those are out there. And we can actually do that with polyurethanes as well. So you can take a polyurethane, instead of mixing part A and part B together, you can have thick film, again, aliphatic for the sunlight. In this case, for the thick film, we want an aromatic, a chemical-resistant polyurethane, or a polyurea, or a combination of those two. And those materials, again, you have to get the right temperatures, right pressure, complicated, expensive equipment, but a lot of people do it because they make good money doing it, but you can put that on at 50, 100, 250 mils, a quarter of an inch thick in a couple passes, and sometimes it cures, and you're able to put it back in immersion within hours or a day or something like that. So those are real interesting technologies. Don, did I miss any of them?
No, you covered it very well, Troy. That was a great short version.
Less than an hour, Mike.
That was a great short version.
Way to go. That's a good job there.
It definitely sounds like there are a lot of coatings to choose from, but why would someone choose an epoxy versus a polyurethane versus an acrylic, Troy?
Yeah. So it's a good question. And quite frankly, I'm going to go back to the basic, you know, coating 101 class. Coatings provide three different ways of protection, okay, of preventing corrosion. So the first one, the biggest one, and almost all coatings do it, and even, as Don mentioned, wood, concrete, aluminum, other structures, is it serves as a barrier, okay? So the one thing you got to think about is building a barrier with a coating, because what happens with corrosion of steel, and again, that's a whole nother hour-long lecture we won't go into, but corrosion of steel requires moisture and oxygen. I'll give you those two. So the things that your body needs and wants are things that destroy carbon steel. And again, in concrete, you got rebar, moisture gets in there, oxygen gets in there, and you get rust. Okay, you get corrosion of steel. So the first thing, and in any case, you want a barrier. So one of those decisions is to build that barrier. In order not to have to build such a thick barrier, we can do a couple other things. We can actually use inhibitive pigments, okay? Pigments that inhibit corrosion. So if moisture gets through the film, and eventually it will, it'll react, these inhibitive pigments will react and passivate the steel. Remember I mentioned red lead earlier? Great at doing that job. I mean, I have seen bridge structures 40, 50 years old that still have their original red lead primer on them. Again, red lead, obviously, for health reasons, is not allowed anymore, but we have molybdates and other items. As I mentioned earlier, acrylic primers, right? So your question, Brie, you know, when would you use an acrylic primer? Well, it's the in-house crew. They're not going to mix a two-component epoxy. It's the in-house crew. They're not going to mix, you know, zinc dust, part A, part B, part C, sometimes depending on what it is. But if they're going to paint metal, as long as they pick an acrylic primer with an inhibitor in it, they can do it. But the most important thing is sacrificial, especially on industrial steel structures. That's what the zinc does. So the zinc sacrifices itself when moisture gets to it so that the steel doesn't corrode. And so when you're picking, you know, and your purpose is, if you're getting new steel, my one big piece of advice is have that steel abrasive glass blast clean in a shop, in an enclosed shop, controlled area, controlled environment, get that cleanliness, that, you know, near white metal that you can get while running it, you know, through a wheel abrader, one of those wheel abrader machines, or blasting it by hand, and get on that zinc. So if you think about, you know, the purpose, if it's corrosion prevention, if I'm getting new steel, I want that coat of zinc and I want it from the shop. After that, the decisions can be all different things. Standard Cadillac, Troy, old school zinc, put it out in the field, put on an epoxy intermediate coat. On the outside, put a polyurethane top coat, and you're done with it. If you want that real longevity, you know, that 20, 30 years, you have a deep color, you know, a dark purple or something, UK blue, you might go for that fluorourethane, that more expensive material that's going to give you a longer life. And again, just looking at the materials, if you know it's going to be a moist environment, I'm going to be over a clarifier in a plant and I can't shut it down, there's going to be moisture in the air, what do you go for? Moisture-cured urethanes. The one thing I didn't mention about moisture-cured urethanes, also cold weather, they can do a little bit better getting down into the 30s or whatever. So if you're going to paint in cold weather, you might go in that type of a direction. And then on immersion service, it just really depends on whether it's in water. And if it's in chemicals, again, those of you new to the business, if it's a chemical immersion, all of the major coating manufacturers have chemical resistance guides. So if you know what the chemicals are, temperatures, concentrations, just talk to the coating manufacturers and they'll put you into the right ballpark for the right material. Did that answer your question, Bree?
Yeah, it definitely does. It sounds like there's a lot of information getting thrown our way, though.
You covered a lot, Troy, for sure.
It actually answered the next question as well about environments and so forth. So,
yeah, okay,
that was great.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Very good.
So I guess, you know, we talked about all of these different types of coatings. Troy, you've been doing a great job at going into more detail about them all. My question to you, Don, is there kind of a universal coating that could be applicable to any or every environment?
Well, if I was going to choose a universal coating to use, I would err to one specifically, whether or not it's, you know, really applicable to any and every environment, you know, is dependent certainly upon the conditions that it's going to see. But, you know, I would look at an epoxy as a universal coating for several reasons. Certainly, as Troy mentioned, you'd want to apply that to a blasted surface if possible. But with a lot of them, it's not necessary to have that. A power tooled surface that's free of any rust or mill scale is also a suitable substrate for a lot of the epoxies that are out there. They will perform. They have also several companies probably have them. I know of one that does for sure, but it was always a favorite of mine when I would recommend a system was what is kind of deemed as a mastic urethane coating. So it has the properties of an epoxy built into it along with the gloss and color retention properties of a urethane coating. They go on at film builds anywhere from 3 to 5 mils per coat on average. And, you know, a two coat system can give you 6 to 10 mils of a dry film thickness of a really good coating system to stand up to chemical environments. Again, you know, not all chemicals, but certainly a majority of them. You certainly want to consult with the coating manufacturer depending on the environment, but gloss and color retention from UV degradation is certainly applicable with something like that. So yeah, if I was going to suggest one, again, most of them, I don't know of any that aren't two components. So that would might be the only downside would be having to mix it from a basic applicator side of the of the equation. But I mean, you know, universally, I think a mastic type urethane coating would be applicable to just about any interior or exterior environment, as well as most chemical environments, again, depending.
Hey, Bree, I would absolutely agree with Don on that. And when I work for a, can't name it, major coating manufacturer, I would get calls from industrial and commercial reps who, of course, have got not enough information to make a good decision. You know, they didn't get enough information from their customer. Their customer is a painter talking to an owner and they don't know. And the answer always was by brand name, which I will leave out, but epoxy, 1-to-1 ratio epoxy, simplest epoxy out there, surface prep. If they don't make it, it'll stick. So I okay. love it. Absolutely agreed on. Excellent.
Okay, awesome.
So knowing, you know, obviously there's all kinds of different coating types. There's got to be, as we know, different application methods. Can you guys kind of run through the most common application types? And on the other side, what are the least common in the protective coatings field?
Mike, honestly, most of these coatings, a brush, a roller, spray equipment works great. And again, the limitations sometimes are where you're doing it. Again, you don't want to be spray painting 150 feet in the air on a water tank or on a bridge if you don't have it contained, because you're going to be painting cars and houses for miles down the road. But most materials actually can be applied, the bulk of the materials that are being used can be applied by any of those methods. A couple caveats there. Zinc, especially inorganic zincs, because of the volume of zinc dust, they really need to be spray applied to make them functional. And then those higher end technologies I talked about, 100% solids, epoxies, or the very thick, you know, polyurethanes or polyurea combination tank lining materials, those have that plural component equipment required. They have heating required and such. So those don't lend themselves well to be brush and roll applied. And Don knows this, he can tell you the same thing. The most effective means is spray application. Okay, so airless spray application, you can move a lot of paint through a pump to a surface very, very quickly. But you do have to be careful and you do have some loss of materials there. So most things, again, in most specifications, again, as a spec writer, I would leave the methods up to the contractor. So brush, roller, spray, if they're all good, they're all good.
So when planning a project, who typically is the one that gets to decide which coatings will be used on a project?
Well, if you're talking spec writer, and I'll let Don chime in here.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. That's what I was going to say, Troy. Yeah, the specification writer, or I mean, the slash owner, you know, probably have a lot to say as to which coatings would be used, in my opinion.
Yeah. And the owner, and again, the one thing as a spec writer is understanding what the owner wants, what their intent is, how long the structure is going to last, you know, whether, you know, color and gloss is important, whether they want it to look like a car finish. But the other thing is your application is going to be best if the contractor is comfortable with that material and has used it. So my preference has been, if I can list several different materials, you know, or similar materials from different manufacturers, then my chance of the contractor finding material that they're comfortable with improves. And so the outcome of the job should improve because they've used that product before. So I don't like forcing a contractor to use certain materials if there isn't a compelling reason to do it.
That makes sense.
So we know that a successful coating project and successful application of a coating relies on a lot of different variables. What are the key factors that affect the success or failure of a coatings project?
A good specification to start.
Yep.
Proper surface prep.
Surface prep is key. My wife is in the house, and if she was here and you asked her that question, she would tell you surface prep because she's heard it too many times. So, yeah. And the other thing, obviously having a qualified contractor doing the work. And one of the most important things in my mind is documentation, contractor quality control. You know, if you're doing it right and we've picked the right materials and you're doing the right surface prep, write it down, take a picture, make a record. Because honestly, if you don't, a couple of years down the road, when everybody's gone from that water company or everybody's not, working on that bridge anymore as a bridge engineer, people forget what's been applied and they don't know how to touch it up. They don't know how to fix it. And they don't know, did it last the 20 years it was supposed to? So documentation, I guess, is one of my other pet peeves to make sure a project goes well, Mike.
You guys actually answered my next question. I was going to ask, how important is surface preparation among all of the factors?
Very.
No, it is. And there's recent studies, my folks have said, they're talking about feathering or whatever. And the answer was, feathering helps. But you know what? If the surface prep, what we did to the spot is most important. And Don mentioned the epoxy mastic, right? Well, just think, the epoxy mastic will go over less than ideal surface prep. Boy, what if you put it over ideal surface prep? It is going to do better.
Makes a lot of sense. So what about, Don, I'll ask you this one then. What are the long-term effects of improperly coated steel?
Well, the first concern would certainly be corrosion and structural integrity of the steel. That certainly it would be number one and jumps out at me. I mean, whether it's long term or short term, I mean, it could be either way. Worker safety certainly comes into play as well with improperly coated steel, especially if corrosion and structural integrity is involved. The cost of recoating to repair or to replace would be other factors that kind of stick out or come to mind, as well as revenues lost by the owner the revenues that would be lost for sure. Aesthetics and appearance. Would play a role too. A poor looking structure that's got peeling product on it, peeling paint on it, certainly doesn't bode well. But I'd say the number one would be obviously the corrosion that's going to be caused, and certainly right behind it the cost of repairing it or replacing it.
We've mentioned the craft worker a little bit, and one thing I know for sure is that a successful coating project really depends on the skill of the craft workers. Don, what kind of trainings does SSBC offer for coating applicators?
I found that SSBC has a ton of training, as we know, and there is definitely stuff that is geared to the basic applicator. There is several e-courses that we offer. There's an applicator basics e-course, a concrete coatings basic e-course, and a spray application basics e-course. So that kind of certainly covers a wide range for the basic applicator and gives them some opportunity to understand what's expected. I mean, we certainly have other areas of coating application, such as thermal spray, pleural component, you know, for polyureas and high solids, intumescent fireproofing, just to name a few others. But again, from a applicator basics, those first three certainly stand out and provide a good groundwork for the new applicator.
So everything we've talked about here, I'm sure there's got to be standards governing coating application and surface preparation and inspection and so forth. Can you guys talk a little bit about the standardization or the standards involved and that govern protective coatings projects?
Yeah, I'll jump on that one a little bit, and Troy, certainly chime in if you feel. SSPC, you know, was built on protecting and preserving concrete, steel, and other structures, substrates through the use of protective coatings. So with that said, standards, were created to govern these applications and practices. So, my first thoughts go to, the surface preparation standards that are out there and have been established by SSPC, from, SP1, solvent cleaning, which is an indirect standard for all other surface prep standards, to commercial blast, SP6 or SP10 near white, or SP5 white metal blast. Those are lay the groundwork, certainly, for the surface preparation standards coating applicators and coating application follows, in my opinion. And then there's a multitude of other standards. A few come to mind, like SSPC PA1, which helps determine, shop and feel conformance of specified code, or I'm sorry, provides best practices for the application and protective coatings to coated or uncoated metal substrates. They use that PA1 quite a bit. Still a very go-to standard. PA2 is another one that determines the compliance to dry film or required dry film thickness. Again, it's been around forever, and I think will continue to be an important standard. I don't see it ever going away. There's another one that comes to mind, Guide 12 for illumination of painting projects. Helps to quantify surface prep, coatings, inspection by the amount of light that is required, minimum and maximum amounts. Those are several that come to mind. I can't think of any more right off the top of my head, but
well, the other one to think about is the performance standards for the paints and the paint systems themselves. So just a little bit of history in SSPC. Early on, SSPC had standards that told people how to make paint, what exactly the ingredients are. Now there's been a transformation, a great transformation. It says, here's a polyurethane paint, 36 or whatever. This is how it should perform. And so SSPC moved to performance specs. They're great. I've spent years working with the architectural and engineering communities and have preached to architects and engineers, don't try to write a standard. Don't try to rewrite, SSPC, SP6, commercial blasting. Just quote the standard, because that's what everybody knows. That's what everybody can read. So spec doesn't, improve itself by getting thicker. It improves itself by getting thinner, and referring to standards. And now that SSPC and NACE are joining forces, it'll make the job of the spec writer even easier.
Troy, I know you mentioned earlier that you actually joined SSPC when we were still the Steel Structure Painting Council. And I know you have over 30 years of experience in the protective coatings industry. So I was curious on how have you seen protective coatings evolve during your career?
So if you want the long answer, a couple years ago, I gave a presentation at the conference and wrote a paper called Watching Paint Dry, and it's available in the proceedings. So if anybody wants the long answer, you can go there. So the short answer is I've already given to you. Lower zero VOCs. People are concerned for the environment. They're concerned for health. And that is the way that we're going. One of the, you know, there's two ways to get there. One of them, an easy way, is waterborne. Again, direct metal acrylics. You know, if you told me when I first started that you could put acrylic, you know, waterborne acrylic directly to metal, I'd laugh at you. All right. So, I mean, all of a sudden we've got this thing. We actually have waterborne epoxies. So the epoxy, instead of being in a solvent, actually is delivered in water. And someday, Don, they're going to figure out how to get part A, part B in water in the same can. And when you open it up and mix it up, it's going to make epoxy. Don't think we're there yet, but you know, there's amazing things going to happen there. Waterborne polyurethanes, even those fluorurethanes, again, based on water, and even the alkyd paint, that old school oil-based paint, well, they have taken that same resin, especially in OEM original equipment manufacturing, and have waterborne alkyds. So it's truly amazing what we've done there. And then the other way to get there, and the other big change, are those 100% solids, ultra high solids, epoxies, polyurethanes, polyureas. And again, those things couldn't happen if we didn't have the improvement in technology of the spray equipment and the controls and computerization and things like that. And so what a lot of those things, the 100% solids, the higher solids, again, my old traditional three coat zinc epoxy urethane, now we're seeing two in one coat systems, one thick coat of a polyurethane, polyurea, or an epoxy, or maybe a zinc primer with a polysiloxane or polyaspartic on top of it. So we're seeing, again, changes really driven by the healthier, you know, low zero VOC. The lead-based paint was actually on its way out before I started, so I can't claim that one.
So this question is actually for both of you. And Troy, we can start with you. What advice would you give to someone who wanted to join the protective coatings industry as a coatings applicator?
Yeah, my advice is do it. The trades and trade jobs have been undervalued for the last several decades. My wife actually works in workforce development where they do all sorts of training for industry. The opportunity is absolutely great. Don's already mentioned it. Get trained. SSPC has got good programs. And then look out there. There are apprenticeship programs that the Department of Labor are paying for. It's easy to get in. You just have to look for that opportunity. Again, study up on it and get started. And the only other piece of advice is realize you're going to start at the bottom. Okay, you're going to be loading the hopper with blast abrasive. You're going to be shoveling abrasive out of the place. You're going to be the gopher. You're going to be the blast cleaner. You're not going to be, you know, the foreman and the boss on day one. You got to work your way up, show what you do. And a lot of these major paint companies that we have today really were started with guys who started on the ground, learned the skill, and created a business and made a great success.
Yeah, to your point, Troy, I really can't say much more, but I agree with that last part. And that's what I was thinking was, I mean, it's certainly a great opportunity for people that want to get into it. But yeah, you're not going to jump to the top right away. And in my many years of being in the industry, I saw that. But I also saw a lot of guys that started out just like you're saying, and moved into that foreman position and on up. So yeah, it's a great career if they're willing to put the time and effort into it. I would agree.
Awesome. Thank you both for that. That's all the topics and questions we actually had for today. Do either of you have anything you'd like to add before we conclude today's podcast?
Surface prep is number one.
There you go. I'll drink to that. No, I'm good, Mike, Bree. I don't really have anything else.
All right. Well, this has been a great conversation, and I have definitely learned a lot myself. I'd like to thank you both for joining us on this episode of the SSPC podcast. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Don't go anywhere just yet. Next, we have the latest segment of SSPC's Coding Talk with Jim Kunkel. And as always, be sure to follow SSPC on social media at the SSPC to stay up to date with all the latest news, and follow the SSPC podcast on Spotify so you never miss an episode.
I'm Jim Kunkel, and welcome to another segment of Coding's Talk. Joining me today is Brian Cheshire, Market Manager for Water and Wastewater at Carboline Company. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you, Jim.
Hey, let's start off by talking about corrosion and other challenges for water and wastewater treatment facilities. In your experience, what are some of the typical causes of corrosion damage to infrastructure in water and wastewater treatment plants?
Sure, Jim. So, you know, while a lot of the common corrosion mechanisms are still going to be at play, you know, things like dissimilar metal corrosion and so on, there are also some types of corrosion that are uniquely prevalent in these exposures. And I wanted to take a minute before I jump into those to really highlight SSPC Guide 27, which does a great job of laying out the different corrosion mechanisms. And then it even goes a step further and talks about different coatings and linings that can be used at different stages of the treatment process. So definitely wanted to highlight that great resource there. But, you know, talking about the different corrosion mechanisms that are prevalent in water, wastewater, and, you know, and especially in the collection systems and then even the treatment processes at a wastewater treatment plant. The first of those would be biogenic sulfide corrosion. So as the name states, this is a biological process that happens in stages. It starts with sulfate reducing bacteria that break down sulfates in the waste stream. And they end up producing hydrogen sulfide and carbon dioxide. The hydrogen sulfide and carbon dioxide will then reduce the pH of the concrete. And then during that process, sulfur oxidizing bacteria attach to the surface as those sulfates are produced. Then those sulfur oxidizing bacteria consume the hydrogen sulfide. And this is really the important part here, but they end up discharging sulfuric acid. So which at that point creates a vicious cycle that can ultimately lead to structural failure. So this particular process occurs in, you know, headspaces of pipelines, pump stations, lift stations. And it also happens in the treatment plant itself, in the preliminary treatment process, and then even in primary treatment. So while that's one, there are a few other corrosion mechanisms, the next being what's called aqueous phase carbonation. So this occurs below the waterline in wastewater treatment plant structures. And what happens is dissolved carbon dioxide ends up evolving as carbonic acid and causes gradual pH reduction of the cement paste in the concrete. And so once again, a vicious cycle that can end up exposing coarse aggregate. And this happens, you know, once again in collection systems and then also in treatment plant structures that are exposed to low pH or wastewater that's low in alkalinity and hardness. So you'll typically see this in secondary treatment and then also in some of your pressurized headspaces. The next major corrosion mechanism that we see is what's called chloride-induced reinforcing steel corrosion. So keep in mind with concrete, you know, as you've discussed on your podcast before, concrete is low in tensile strength. Therefore, it has to be reinforced with steel rebar. And so because concrete is permeable, what can happen over time is chloride ions and oxygen can penetrate through the concrete. Once it reaches that steel rebar, then your corrosion cells can be formed. And what ends up happening as the corrosion buildups increase, you end up getting expansion of the rebar. Ultimately, that will crack the concrete. And so from there, you know, you'll see rust bleed, cracking, spalling, and so on. And so you can see this in different areas of the treatment process, but you'll see this more often than not in coring contact chambers and really any structure where sodium hypochlorite and ferric chloride are present. And, you know, kind of closing out with the corrosion mechanisms, you know, you have to deal with chemical attack from some of the different treatment chemicals, and then also some of the organic acids that you may encounter in the solids treatment portion. So keep in mind, you know, these can affect steel and concrete and can be present really in emergent service as well as secondary containment. And then lastly, you know, just a quick mention of some other corrosion mechanisms are erosion, you know, which happens when you get grit and large particles combined with turbulent flow. And then abrasion and cavitation are also things that can happen in a treatment facility.
You know, since we're covering coatings used in water and wastewater treatment facilities, what are some of the most commonly used coating systems used on steel and concrete substrates?
Sure, Jim. So first I wanted to highlight really just some of your more light duty materials that you'll really see more for everyday maintenance. And those would be your alkyds and acrylics, you know, and let me repeat again that these will be used in lighter duty areas, you know, because you definitely are not going to want to place these in your heavier corrosion areas. But the good thing about these materials is that they're single component, are easy to apply in the plant, can be applied to various surfaces. You know, but some cons of them, you know, first talking about alkyds, you know, they will chalk. They're going to have very poor color retention. They can become brittle over time. And then they're going to have relatively high VOCs due to the fact that they're solvent based. You know, acrylics, on the other hand, you know, some of the cons of them is these are going to be softer films. They're going to have lower abrasion resistance and they're going to take longer to cure. So moving on from the single component materials, really some of your more robust materials you're going to see are going to be your multi-component materials, the first of which being epoxies. And when I say the term epoxy, it's a very, very broad statement because there are multiple types of epoxies. And then you even could classify them in solvent-based epoxies and then 100% solids epoxies. And so these can be used from anything from lining concrete and steel structures in wastewater environments. You even see epoxies used as primer and intermediate coats for coating systems that are in atmospheric exposure, you know, which can include tank exteriors and really any other miscellaneous steel structure that's exposed to the elements. So epoxies, the reason they're used, you know, pretty prevalently, especially on the lining side, in a wastewater treatment plant, you know, they give you good abrasion resistance, good chemical resistance, and good overall corrosion resistance. Also, you know, they give you pretty good flexibility in application. You know, you can apply these via single leg airless, portal component, and then even some formulations can have the addition of a mortar and can be troweled on. So, you know, and then I would say the last thing is they give you very good film build capabilities, you know, especially, you know, when we're talking about the linings. You know, some of the cons, they're going to chalk, they're going to have poor color retention. Epoxies by nature have very little elongation. And then some formulations can be subject to a mean blush. So the next generic material I'd like to discuss is polyurethanes. And let me preface this conversation by saying, you know, there are multiple types of polyurethanes. You could really break these down into your atmospheric, you know, your aliphatic acrylics. And then you could talk about the aromatic, which are going to be used for more lining situations. And so, you know, briefly on the atmospheric side, aliphatic acrylic urethanes give you good UV resistant top coat, you know, for various surfaces. But these by nature are typically very low film build, and they can be sensitive to moisture and humidity. So just some things to consider there. On the lining side, these aromatic polyurethane linings are used for various structures in wastewater treatment. And then also for lining potable water storage tanks, both steel and concrete. Some benefits of these materials is they have higher elongation properties than epoxies, and they're able to be applied at extremely high thicknesses. Some other benefits, they're very fast cure, very fast return to service, and they give you some crack bridging capability. Some cons, though, they're going to have low tolerance to moisture. And because of that, they're going to require a primer on concrete. And then portable component spray is going to be your application here. So, Jim, for sake of time, you know, that we could talk for probably the next hour on different coating types. But just note, those are some of the more common. You know, there are other types such as polyureas, vinyl esters, and then even your ultra weatherables. Like your polysiloxanes and fluoropolymers. But, you know, those could be saved for another conversation on another day.
Yeah, Brian, I absolutely agree. We could talk about these topics related to generic coating systems for hours. So, you know, as you already know, January 1st, 2023, water treatment infrastructure for potable water will have a new health requirement called NSF 600, which deals with potable water linings. Could you provide a brief overview of NSF 600 and how it will impact coatings used around potable water?
Yeah, sure. So NSF 600, the name of the standard is Health Effects Evaluation and Criteria for Chemicals in Drinking Water. And so the main intent of this standard is to create a single source document where the allowable concentrations of various chemicals can be housed. You know, previously these were listed in the annexes of both NSF 61 and NSF 60. So, but what does this mean for the coating industry? So, the significant change that really affects us is the fact that several chemicals have seen their allowable concentrations severely lowered. Those chemicals being xylene, toluene, and ethyl benzene. And this is important to note because many of these traditional or many of the traditional solvent-based linings that you've seen used in water tanks are typically formulated with those solvents. So, you know, because this is a drastic change, NSF is giving coating manufacturers until January 1, 2023 to be in compliance with this. You know, after that, you know, any products introduced to the potable water industry are going to have to meet both NSF 61 and NSF 600 to be compliant. You know, some common responses that you'll see from coating manufacturers moving forward. You know, first you're going to see a shift to more the usage of more 100% solids epoxies and 100% solids aromatic polyurethane linings. You know, the current formulations of these materials, you know, will allow them very easily to be recertified under this standard. But in addition to these, you know, you may see coating manufacturers introduce some new technologies, and you may also see some existing products be reformulated to be able to meet the standard and be in compliance.
You know, Brian, what a great conversation we're having. In closing out this segment of coatings talk, is there anything that we didn't talk about that you'd want to leave with the listeners?
Sure, Jim. So, you know, really one of the main points I wanted to drive home is, you know, that there's a lot of factors to consider when selecting a coating or lining. You know, some different questions to consider. You know, first, you know, really what specific function will this coating perform? You know, is this a lining? Is this secondary containment? Is it just going to be atmospheric exposure? You know, and then, you know, what is the environment and exposure? You know, talking about wastewater treatment, are we in the preliminary treatment, primary treatment stage, or are we further down the treatment process? So understanding, you know, where we are in that process and some of the different corrosion mechanisms that we need to hold up to, you know, will greatly affect coating selection there. And one thing I'll say, you know, with linings and wastewater, you know, you should really consider materials that have good adhesion, you know, good chemical resistance, good abrasion resistance, and low permeability. you know, and then, you know, some other questions you can ask, or, you know, are there any application restrictions on the job site? Because sometimes, you know, spray application may not be possible. But the last thing I would say, you know, when considering what coating you're wanting to select is, you know, what is the expected service life? You know, as with many things, there's always a trade-off of cost versus performance. So you have to consider those and weigh those, and then even look at a lot of the other installation costs, you know, such as containment, scaffolding, that will be present on a lot of these jobs. But Jim, the last thing I would like to point out is, you know, surface preparation is going to really allow you to be more successful. You know, all these things that we've mentioned before, you know, they're kind of a moot point if the surface preparation is not there. So, you know, your service life of any coating or lining is going to be directly tied to how good your surface preparation was. You know, so I definitely wanted to highlight that, you know, it must be first appropriate for the selected coating or lining system, but it ultimately must be executed correctly in order to get the best long-term asset protection.
Brian, thank you for being on this segment of Coating Stock.
Thank you for having me, Jim.
And thank you for tuning into this episode of the SSPC podcast. If you're interested in finding out more about protective coatings, head on over to sspc.org to find out more about SSPC training and standards. Before you go, make sure to follow the SSPC podcast on Spotify or wherever you listen so that you never miss an episode.